It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up on Central Time, we'll take a look at the new face of American unemployment in a rebounding economy.
First, the U.S. economy saw healthy job growth last month. According to data released by the Bureau of Labor Statistics, February saw a nationwide increase of 235,000 jobs. Unemployment dipped a bit and wages are up.
Our next guest tells us what the numbers signal about the health of the economy, what it means for monetary policy moving forward, and how Wisconsin is doing.
Bruce Hansen is with us now. He's a professor and the Phipps Chair in the Economics Department at UW-Madison. Bruce, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Put this number in context, 235,000 jobs. So we've seen smaller growth. We've seen bigger numbers over the last few years. Where does this stack up?
This is very consistent with what we've seen over the last several years, that the economy is showing growth, continuous, solid, exactly as expected.
And we've seen 70-some months of some form of job growth, a pretty long stretch there. These numbers in the mid-200,000s, some people were calling them mediocre, kind of slow growth in the past. But why people seem to react encouragingly to this new report?
It's not really a big change from what's been going on. I think a lot of people who call this slow growth are kind of making stories up. There's nothing slow about the economic recovery we've had, a contrast to other economic recoveries. And right now we're sitting at a case where the unemployment rate in the country is quite low, 4.7%, and we've kind of hit the peak of the expansion.
And one thing people have been watching for in these numbers is whether the economy is doing well enough for the Federal Reserve to increase interest rates. They're scheduled to meet next week. What are you expecting to see from that meeting?
There will be an increase in the federal funds rate, meaning that short-term interest rates will tick up a notch. What's unclear is if that will have any impact on what's important, namely long-term interest rates. So when people buy a house and borrow or a car, what they're really looking at is a more long-term interest rate. Those may not necessarily increase just because of the change in the Fed policy. So that remains to be seen. But yes, there will be an increase of the Fed funds rate.
I know the numbers out today are just one data point among many. What are you looking at in the fundamentals of the U.S. economy right now?
Right. The fundamentals of the economy are good. The wages are really starting to increase over the last year. Employment is solid. There's some concern that inflation is starting to show maybe signs that it's going to come back up to 2%. The bond market is showing it's positioning itself for an expectation of inflation, and that's partly why we expect the Federal Reserve to try to increase interest rates over the next year.
Let's talk about wage growth, because for a long time in the recovery from the Great Recession, that was something people were focusing on. Even as jobs started to come back, it seemed like wages were staying stagnant. A, am I right about that? B, what's turning that around, if so?
Wage growth is different according to sectors and according to education. So wage growth has been stagnant for people with lower education levels. Wage growth has been high for people at high education levels. So the biggest thing we've seen over the last 30 years is a huge split between high school grads and college grads and people with grad degrees. So wages have been booming at the high end, booming for those with high education, been very stagnant and dropping for people with high school degrees. That is the distinction. So it's stagnant depending really on who you are and where you are in the economy. That's going to continue, by the way, and it's only going to be accelerated, most likely, in the future.
Talking to Bruce Hansen, professor of economics at the UW-Madison, looking at new job numbers out today, what they say about the economy. And Bruce, following up on that point, I think a lot of people have been looking at is a decline in manufacturing jobs, where those high school education employees might have gotten a decent paying job in the past. What are we seeing in manufacturing jobs in recent months and years?
Well, manufacturing as a part of the U.S. economy has been slowly and steadily declining ever since 1950. It's somewhat leveled off, but it's fewer and fewer parts of our economy deal with manufacturing. Now, in Wisconsin, that's not entirely the case. We have a much larger manufacturing sector in Wisconsin than typically in the country, and it's been doing well. We've actually had an overall increase in manufacturing employment since the Great Recession. But what do we expect to see in the long term going forward? Decline in manufacturing. It's not the future of the U.S. The future of the U.S. is going to be services and other high-tech issues. We should not be looking for manufacturing to save us.
And when you talk about manufacturing not coming back, are you saying we're not making stuff? Or I've heard some people say we're making stuff, but because of automation, there's fewer jobs involved in making that stuff.
Both. Both are going on. More automation. In Wisconsin particularly, industrial machinery. Machinery is our big thing here. It's a huge part of our economy. We rely on it for our exports and other things. Very important. But it's going to be a declining part of the U.S. economy as we look forward 10 years, 20 years especially.
As a matter of federal policy, we have a president who ran on the idea of bringing manufacturing jobs back to the country using, in part, trade policy to do that, deregulation to do that. Is he trying to turn back the tide here?
Well, those kind of policies will have the converse effect of what he hopes. These policies will only get in the way. So right now, we have people who try to export machinery out of Wisconsin. Our major exporting partners are Canada, Mexico, and China. Trade policies of this form will stymie their exports.
So are you seeing trade wars and retaliation making it harder to export things from Wisconsin and the U.S.?
It'll be a disaster if we get into a trade war. So remains to be seen if that will happen. But those things won't. Those discussed possible policies will not help manufacturing.
You said things like services and technology are the wave of the future. Is there a way for a state government, a federal government, to ride that wave?
Less than they might think. Governments can do less for the economy than most people speculate. Mostly what the government can do is get out of the way, let businesses do their thing, let people produce, let people travel. Those are the things that tend to make productivity rise. The future is inventing new things. It's making it's productivity. And you have to unleash the economy, and the government doesn't do a good job of that. Generally, the government gets in the way.
Some people have pointed toward government investments in some kind of educational infrastructure, high-tech training, that sort of thing. Is that a way where the government can play a positive role?
Definitely. All the evidence points to that growth is achieved through education and having an educated workforce, educated people. Everything we show that part of the reason why productivity is starting to have slower growth now than recently is there's been a decline of the shift of the workforce towards high education. The growth of people going to higher education has slowed down. So we need to encourage that. We need to encourage more people to go to college, get graduate degrees, get trained in technical trade degrees. All that can help.
Over time, we see the economy expanding and contracting, and some people, you mentioned we're maybe at the peak of the expansion now. Some people are wondering, are we going to see another recession in the next few years? Is that something you are looking for or worried about?
It can always happen. We don't really know. It's almost impossible to forecast a recession, but it could happen.
And are we, before the last recession, people pointed toward bubbles, an over-exuberant housing market, things like that. Are there any worrisome spots in the current expansion where, the numbers might look good, but they're, disguising something hollow underneath that could lead to a collapse?
Nothing obvious. Housing markets prices have really super rebounded since the height of the crisis. Is that a bubble? It's hard to know. They haven't come up at nearly the same pace as they did in the first 7 years after 2000, where the acceleration almost doubled the price of housing in the U.S. This hasn't happened again, but you never know.
We'll leave it there. Bruce, thanks a lot for joining
okay.
us today.
You're welcome.
That's Bruce Hansen, professor and Phipps chair at the Economics Department at UW-Madison. He joined us to talk about the latest federal jobs report. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, it's Food Friday, and we'll learn the art of French countryside cooking with a James Beard Award-winning cookbook author.
First, as we just heard, according to the Department of Labor, the U.S. economy added 235,000 jobs last month. Unemployment is also down to its lowest level since the Great Recession started. Well, this is good news. The numbers don't tell the full story.
Nearly 20 million people are still unemployed nationwide, and many of them are held back for a variety of complex reasons, ranging from prior convictions to living in areas with fewer job opportunities.
Gina Smilek is with us now. She's an economics reporter at Bloomberg News in Washington. She co-wrote a piece called "This is the New Face of American Unemployment." Gina, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, we hear about unemployment and, you know, some people are in and out of jobs over time. You're focusing on a group that is facing longer-term unemployment. Tell us a little bit about what you set out to accomplish in this series of features.
Right. So our thought when we were trying to approach this story was to really explain structural unemployment. So there are kind of two sorts of unemployment in the economy. The first is cyclical. So what we see every time there's a recession is all these people get laid off of their jobs or they get fired, and it's temporary. It's kind of a response to the economic downturn that we're seeing. But then there's also this other group, and that's people who are unemployed even when the economy is really strong, you know, even when employers are actively trying to find sort of, you know, in a sense, scrape the bottom of the barrel and find any workers they can. These people, for some reason, because of some sort of barrier, they can't find a job. And we were trying to explain in 2017, at the moment we're sitting at, when we're reaching what economists think is sort of full employment, who those people are, because it looks a little bit different than it has in prior recoveries and expansions. And so that was sort of the entire purpose we had in writing this story.
And before we get into the profiles, why was it important to actually, you know, find people with a name and a face? We, you know, when we talk about the economy, we do numbers and statistics a lot.
Yeah, well, I think that's exactly the thing. You know, I think if you have a number or a statistic, it's just a number or statistic. But I think these people look and sound a lot like people readers probably know in their real lives. And so I think it was a way to sort of drive home how this data that we're seeing and these figures that we're talking about relate to the real world that people interact with every day.
And how did you go about finding people in this position of structural unemployment, of being out of work, regardless of what the economy was doing?
Yeah, so, you know, we have a lot of rich data from the Bureau of Labor Statistics and elsewhere that tells us sort of what this group of people look like. You know, they're facing some unique situations. Some of them are unemployed because they're stuck in place. They're in a region that has lost a lot of its jobs. Some of them have some sort of criminal history, and that keeps them from getting jobs. Some of them are currently dealing with some sort of drug abuse issue or something like that. And so we knew that sort of broadly what the problems were, what the data was telling us. And from that, we just went ahead and sort of looked for people in the places that were most intensely experiencing those problems. So, like, for example, one of the ones I did was the stuck in place. And for that, we looked in West Virginia because we know that coal mining has really seen sort of a mass exodus within the last decade. And a lot of people are sort of stuck in the places where they used to have those jobs without any real means to leave to get new jobs.
Yeah, let's talk about Tyler Moore from West Virginia. He was searching really far and wide to try to find a job, not a fancy job, an entry-level, low-pay job.
Yeah, so Tyler's story was fascinating. He grew up right on the border of West Virginia and Kentucky. In the town he lived in West Virginia is called Mingo. The county is called Mingo. And he really, really struggled because he had a job in a coal mine and he lost that job for smoking marijuana. But then what he found is that he couldn't even after he stopped using drugs, even after he cleaned up, he couldn't even get back on the ladder to find an entry-level job because the local McDonald's and local Walmart have waiting lists. You know, you have to wait 6 months to get a call back. And the real issue for someone like Tyler is that he didn't have a lot of money either. And so it really was impossible for him to just move to town with better job prospects and try and find something because there's no way he could pay that first month of rent.
And he also has a story I think a lot of people, a conflict a lot of people would have. He has family in Mingo, West Virginia, an aging father, I think it was, with health problems. So how far away does he want to move to get a job? How mobile does he really want to be? How mobile can he be?
Yeah, you know, that's exactly the issue. He didn't want to move away from his father. What he has done is he moved, you know, fairly far away over into Kentucky ultimately to find work. And he really lucked out because he So Tyler was previously in rehab, and his rehab facility ended up taking him back and helping him to find a job. And, you know, when he was talking to me, he was just saying, you know, if this hadn't happened, I don't know what I would have done. You know, he was in a really tough spot between a rock and a hard place. And I think that while his story has a hopeful end, it also kind of tells this tale of how difficult it can be to get out of a place like Mingo.
And then your colleagues wrote about some other people facing structural unemployment. Leroy Moore in Berkeley, California, not an area in economic decline, certainly. What is Leroy's story?
Yes, so Leroy's story is that he has a disability. And when you have a disability, you know, obviously it's this entire sort of nexus of barriers to employment that people who are more able-bodied just don't face. So Moore has cerebral palsy, and he grew up in the suburbs of Hartford, Connecticut, like you said. He now lives in California. And his disability has continually been a barrier, which is something that we've seen throughout the entire country. And Moore's story is sort of unique, but, you know, this is a broader issue we see within the data. We've seen disability filings really creep up. We've seen people who report working with a disability really creep up. So those people aren't receiving disability insurance. They're just reporting that they have one in a lot of cases. And so it's really interesting that this has become more of an issue in the United States as a whole. It's not just this individual story. And so it's probably something that needs to be addressed as a barrier to employment. It's why we wanted to focus on it in the story.
And it leads often towards long-term unemployment when people can't find a job that fits their disability.
Yeah, absolutely. And Moore had this really great quote that my colleague Patty quoted in the story. And he said there's this invisibility surrounding people with disabilities, which I think is probably fairly accurate, certainly in the job market. You know, I think there's a lot of times companies don't have some sort of system in place to make sure that these people can work or to recognize the abilities that they do have. It's been an issue.
We're talking to Gina Smilek, economics reporter at Bloomberg News. She was part of a series on the face of unemployment in the United States, people who are facing structural employment, long-term unemployment for a variety of reasons. Another reason, Gina, and this is a story that's probably familiar to a bunch of our listeners, Mike Schlager from Buffalo, New York, an older worker out of work and facing challenges because of his age.
Yeah, yeah. So this is one of those stories that we just hear time and again as we report on the labor market. Mike is a talented guy. He's worked his entire life, and then he got laid off, and now he can't find another job. And, you know, he's 55, and he's saying, you know, I'm applying. I'm getting lots of callbacks. But the second I go in for an interview and they see that I'm a 55-year-old guy and I probably only have a decade left in the labor force, I'm just not worth the investment for these employers anymore. And so he's just sitting there, and his abilities are not going to work, and it really bothers him.
What kind of things has he tried to overcome that?
So he has worked closely with a job search service, a community service, that has helped him, you know, work on his resume, work on his interviewing skills. But the issue for Mike is that those aren't really the problems. You know, as he points out, he gets callbacks all the time. He gets interviews. It's more the issue that they're seeing him and then deciding that because of his age, he's not qualified for the position.
Are there solutions out there for this? I mean, on the face of it, sounds like age discrimination, but it sounds like that might be really hard to prove.
Well, that is the real issue, because age discrimination is illegal. And so companies, and Mike mentioned this, companies are very careful not to do anything that is provably discriminatory against age. You know, they don't ask for your age. They don't do any of those sorts of things. But, I mean, you can tell when someone walks in, obviously, that they're a slightly older person. And so it is really hard to prove. It's a challenge. I think one thing that we've seen a lot of communities do is try and educate employers about sort of the things that aging workers can bring to their workforce. And one thing that we've seen from the private sector a real push toward is this idea of sort of keeping employers with them as they age. So I did a separate story recently about employers who are having programs where people can come back and mentor their younger colleagues, even through retirement, so work on a part-time basis. We've seen a big shift toward that in Europe, and I think that increasingly in the U.S. we're seeing companies employ that kind of idea.
I wanted to talk a little bit about drug issues, too. People with David Wolf in Florida had a drug-related felony conviction. And you also talked to an employer, a steel company employer, who got a lot of people signing up for jobs who couldn't pass the drug test. What are we seeing there?
Yeah, so this is a really interesting one. As your listeners probably know, America is sort of in the throes of this opioid epidemic, where we're seeing a lot of people addicted not just to prescription pills, but also to heroin. And so it's brings with it a lot of economic fallout. One of the problems we're seeing is that workers are scarce in some industries. So I talked to this steel factory owner or CEO in just outside of Pittsburgh, and he was telling me that, you know, it's really hard to find an employee who can pass a drug test these days. And it's not a new problem. You know, this has been going on for about a decade. And he had this great anecdote from the recession. He was telling me, you know, during the height of the recession, he went on a local radio show. He talked about the fact that he was having trouble hiring workers. He got probably about 100 people just snaking through his gravel parking lot the next day trying to apply for jobs. And when he went ahead and tested them, you know, had them all take drug tests, about two-thirds of them failed. So I think that was, to me, that really drove home what a big problem this is for employers, because, you know, those tests are fairly expensive. The process of interviewing people is fairly expensive. And then if at the end of the day, you don't walk away with an employee out of it, it's a real problem.
And this is a demanding, potentially dangerous job where you need people who can pass drug tests, as I understand.
Right, absolutely. You don't want someone working around heavy steel machinery. The other point that Jeff Pfeiffer, the CEO, made is that this stuff is really, really intense and challenging to operate. You know, these steel rollers that they're working with pull steel wire down to the thousandth of the millimeter. And so it's extremely precise. You have to be really alert when you're doing it. The raw product is quite expensive. So if you mess up, it's really costly for the company. You know, these are the kinds of things where you need a sober workforce.
We'll leave it there for now. Gina, thanks a lot for joining us and sharing your reporting.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for having me on.
We've been talking to Gina Smilek. She's an economics reporter at Bloomberg News in Washington. She joined us today to talk about a series there looking at unemployment nationwide, putting a human face on people who've been unemployed for a long time for various reasons. We've got a link to that reporting over on the Central Time Facebook page.
Coming up after the news, a James Beard Award-winning cookbook author shares her love of rustic French country cooking with us. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, a look at a widening sexual harassment scandal in the U.S. military.
First, for our next guest, the good life means puttering around a garden in Provence, keeping goats and making goat cheese. For her, few things are as exciting as a fresh tomato or a new potato newly dug from the garden. In fact, she's known for inspiring cooks to garden and getting gardeners into the kitchen.
And now she's sharing her love of French countryside cooking in a new book that draws from the bounty of the garden, the barnyard, the field, and the forest.
Georgianne Brennan is a James Beard Award-winning cookbook author, journalist, and entrepreneur. Her latest book is La Vie Rustique, Cooking and Living in the French Style. She's also the owner of an online company called LaVieRustique.com, Sustainable Living in the French Style. Georgianne, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I want to talk pronunciation. We were arguing over La Vie Rustique, or should we try to get a Frenchified version of rustique or something? Are we saying it right?
Well, I think that's why I chose the English spelling of the rustic, because you can put a French flair to it if you want, or not.
Well, you start out talking about your time in Provence, where you really lived closely with the whole process about bringing food from the farm and, you know, the barnyard and the forest to the table. And it was a lot of work, you said, but it was also one of the most deeply rewarding times in your life. Why was that?
I think it was partly because I grew up in Southern California in a beach town on the ocean, and kind of knew, you know, we fished and we got abalone and went berry picking and what was to become Disneyland area. So I had that sense of the land and the sea, but to really live there and understand intimately that everything you got, you somehow had to do yourself, was so powerful.
And did you feel just more attuned to the world, to your food, to nature when you were doing that?
I really did. It was extraordinary to learn from my French neighbors that you went out in the forest and you got mushrooms, you got the wild asparagus, and you brought it home and you cooked it. And then you had this wonderful meal, mostly of very simple things, with your family or your friends.
And a big part of what you were doing there played a key role, the potager, the sort of the garden that grew your food. Tell us about that concept.
That was so astonishing to me because, you know, the gardens I had known growing up, you planted in spring and then you harvested in late summer and fall and, you know, you canned a lot of things. But these gardens went year-round, so there was always something growing. You were always planting something for the next season, and so there was always something for the table every single day, fresh from the garden. And actually, the garden I have here where I live in California is actually has a larger floor space, footprint, if you will, than my house.
Now, we're here in Wisconsin. At least part of the year, it's tough to keep things growing, I'll be honest. But make the case for us to do as much as we can to stretch out that gardening season so it's not just, as you say, plant in spring, eat in the fall.
I think that, you know, one of the things in your part of the world, and I have lived in cold places, so I know a little bit of what that's like, is to really think about the seasons and what you can do quickly. I think lettuces are among the first things that we can grow in the spring, radishes, and not think quite so. And then in the summer, of course, all your summer crops, look for shorter season varieties. And then as the French do, when the tomatoes are green and the frost is coming, you can cut those vines and bring them inside and keep them in the kitchen, in a closet, you know, wherever, and they will gradually ripen. They won't be like they're fresh picked, but they'll be a wonderful fresh tomato from your garden. And during the fall, a lot of the root crops really like the cold weather. Parsnips don't get sweet until they've had a touch of frost.
Now, when you were living in Provence and living this sustainable eating lifestyle, it was really hard work, as I said, and it was a time where it seemed like your whole day was spent sort of doing those things to put food on your table, washing dishes. It was all sort of tied together, and it seems like a lot of people don't have that much time. So how can we make this something we can add to our lives, even when we're a little time-strapped?
Right. I think, at least for me, one of the things is keep some fresh herbs on your windowsill in your kitchen. It's not a big deal, and don't try to grow them and sustain them over a long period of time, but use them. Buy the little plant, and then just clip off the fresh chives or cut off the fresh basil leaves. And it's a little bit like going out to your garden, and you're bringing something fresh in. You're not going to make your own goat cheese. Most of us aren't. However, especially in your wonderful Wisconsin cheese country, just taking some fresh cheese and sprinkling a little bit of herb de Provence on it, drizzling it with some olive oil, it has that link to the field and the orchard without you actually doing that work. But just a little extra thoughtfulness about where something's coming from, it inspires me.
We're talking to Georgianne Brennan. Her new book is La Vie Rustique, or Rustique, Cooking and Living in the French Style. And I want to get into a couple recipes now, Georgianne. We've got these on our Central Time Facebook page. The first one, green garlic and new potato soup. Green garlic will be one of our early visitors in our gardens around the state. Coming up pretty soon, actually. Can you talk us through this recipe?
Sure. The green garlic is basically like a green onions before the bulbs develop and start to dry, so it has a milder flavor. So what I do, and I have the green garlic, I just harvested some last night here, and I pull it up and pull off the thick sheath that surrounds what will become the cloves and the bulb, and leave only about an inch of the green, and then saute it in a little butter with some minced shallots, and just until it begins to release, to soften and release its aroma. And then I take it out and strain it, squishing through the essence of the garlic. Return that to the pan. Add some homemade or purchased stock, some potatoes. Let it simmer down till the potatoes are done. Puree it, a little sea salt, freshly ground pepper, and then finish it with a drizzle of creme fraiche.
Mmm, that sounds really good. So, like Rob was saying, but we're not quite into garlic season here in Wisconsin. What's going to happen if we use regular grocery store garlic?
It's just fine. You might use regular garlic. Use, I would say, 4 to 6 cloves, and then that would be fine.
What do you think of using, I mean, there are different methods of preparing garlic, and sometimes I wonder, well, which one is best? It's so labor-intensive to chop the little tiny cloves of garlic, and my hands always smell like garlic for a day afterwards, I swear.
That's a
bonus.
I know, I so agree.
Yeah. Sometimes I like it, sometimes I don't. And then you've got the garlic press, which gets all the juices out, which I kind of am leaning toward lately. Do you have a feeling about which way you like to prepare your garlic?
That's a really good question, and I sort of think it depends on how you're using it. You know, if you want to have some kind of, you know, chunks in a marinara sauce, I would go ahead and chop it. And I sometimes think it doesn't have to be minced so tiny, tiny. I really don't do that. So a little bit of the larger chunks, they cook down. You know, maybe if I'm doing a salad dressing and you want to add a little, I think the garlic squeeze is fine.
Now, we've made our green garlic and new potato soup. Any things you'd suggest pairing with it?
Glass of red wine, some crusty bread, and a robust green salad, and you've got dinner.
Well, we're talking right now about French countryside cooking with James Beard award-winning author Georgianne Brennan. Her new book is called La Vie Rustique, Cooking and Living in the French Style.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a love of this style of cooking, the French country-style cooking? And do you cook with foods fresh out of your garden or even freshly foraged foods, French style or not? Do you enjoy cooking along with the seasons? What are some of your favorite ways to do that? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Do you keep a kitchen garden, by the way? Do you keep those herbs in your kitchen growing all the time? 800-642-1234, or post and find recipes on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll pick up our conversation in just a little bit here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Right now, we're continuing our exploration of French country cooking, and you can join us at 800-642-1234. Do you like to cook like our guest does, food fresh from the garden? Do you get maybe more satisfaction with food you grow yourself from farm to table? And what about the French aspect of this? Are there certain flavors that you think of as French, you look forward to? Maybe you like to splurge on a truffle and do something kind of fun with that. Maybe there's a tart that you like or a dessert. Call us at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
James Beard award-winning cookbook author Georgianne Brennan stays with us. Her new book is La Vie Rustique, Cooking and Living in the French Style. Let's look at another recipe now, Georgianne. We talked about that soup. Oh, and here's something that could actually go with it. We have the recipe on our Facebook page for caramelized leek flatbread with black olives and soft cheese. Tell us about that one.
Well, it's just one of those very basic recipes that you can adapt throughout the season with just about anything. It's a take on the French flatbread pis à la dière, which is smothered with caramelized onions, olives, and then anchovies. So this one, make your basic pizza-like dough, flatbread dough, and then cut down, you know, slice the leeks into thin pieces, not the dark greens, just the whites and the pale green, and then cook them down very slowly with a tiny bit of sugar and the extra virgin olive oil and some butter until they just get to a nice, dark, lush brown, fully caramelized, and spread those on top of the rolled-out flatbread. Add some soft cheese, any kind of farmer cheese, goat cheese. You could even add blue cheese to it, any kind. Dot with some black olives, and then brush those crust along the edge with a little of the olive oil so they'll get nicely browned, and pop it into a hot oven for about 15 minutes.
Oh, that sounds pretty fantastic. So is this, I don't know, maybe this is oversimplifying it. Is this sort of like a French version of pizza in a way?
Absolutely. You know, of so many countries and cultures, they have something that is a bread of different compositions and then add some toppings to it.
Let's bring on a caller now. We've got John on the line in Freedom at 800-642-1234. John, hi.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. What do you want to tell us about, John?
You know, if you know what you're doing, foraging in the state of Wisconsin at any time of the year is fairly simple. I'm going to start in the next few months here getting wild leeks, morels, meadow rue, a bunch of other different plants that come up early. Look all year for raspberries, blueberries, blackberries. Get rusty crayfish, make a quiche with the, the above, deer hunt all year. You can find this food almost anywhere in the state if you know what to do.
And John, I want to ask, I could identify those berries and the deer, but where did you learn to forage the other stuff that maybe the rest of us might not know from a random plant?
I have been interested in wild foraging since I've been 12 years old, so it's going on 30 years now. Started learning in Boy Scouts, went to the library, got books, learned, talked to other people who are interested in foraging, and just keep going, including adult beverages like home brewing acorn beer.
Acorn beer, wow.
I've never heard of that.
How does that taste?
A lot like a hazelnut brown.
Huh.
Only sweeter.
John, thank you so much. Georgian, your kind of guy, it sounds like. Do you forage for in Northern California?
Could not have been a more wonderful call in, because that's, you know, it brings to the point that wherever you live, this kind of seeking out in nature the fields, the forest, and then combining it all is possible. Except I'm jealous. Out here in California, we can't find those wonderful raspberries and blueberries in the wild.
Now, he said one of the things he likes to look for, and I love to eat, is morels. And
I knew you were going to say that.
Yeah, I got it. So maybe that's going to be coming up pretty soon here in Wisconsin. That's exciting for me. But you have some recipes for morels, too, in your cookbook. What do you like to do with these foraged mushrooms and then truffles? But I guess a truffle is not exactly a mushroom. It's something different. But tell us about some of those more earthy flavors.
Well, the morels, as you say, have a wonderful earthy flavor, and they're really a treat. And I like to just cook them down with a little shallot and butter, and then maybe add creme fraiche, some whole cream, and make a morel sauce, cream sauce. It's a classic over grilled steaks.
Uh-huh.
That way.
And what about pasta? I bet it would be good on pasta.
Absolutely. Super simple on pasta, just to really show off the flavor of the morels. I think you have something that's so fresh and special, you don't want to swamp it with too many different flavors, in my opinion.
John, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. A couple of months off, we just got a note, the Muscadet Morel Festival isn't until mid-May, May 20th and 21st, so don't go out hunting those morels just yet. We're talking to Georgian Brennan. Her book is La Vie Rustic, Cooking and Living in the French Style. You've got a crepe recipe, Georgian. Talk about making crepes and then what we can do with them. I imagine they're pretty flexible for a lot of these garden, foraged, et cetera, ingredients.
Absolutely. They're wonderful. Again, it's sort of like we were talking about with the flatbread, you know, a bread that you put some kind of a topping on. And so many cultures have thin pancakes. The French, of course, probably the most famous. But they're simple and easy to make, and they freeze really well. So sometimes I like to make them ahead, put a piece of wax paper between each one so they don't stick together, and they thaw out quickly. And they can take either go a sweet direction or savory. For savory, some of those morel mushrooms would be good with maybe some spinach mixed in or some foraged wild greens or some chard, a little bit of sauce, wrap them, maybe add some ham and wrap it up and finish it with a bit of a bechamel sauce and a sprinkle of cheese. For the sweets, pretty much whatever's in season. Some of those berries we were talking about make a wonderful filling for a crepe, strawberries. And instead of cheese, whipped cream.
Wow, that sounds fantastic. Mm. Yeah, I'm a fan of almost any kind of crepe like that. And I want to ask you, Georgianne, are there any other key French ingredients that we can access here in Wisconsin that we can cook maybe this weekend if we want to bring a little of this French countryside home with us?
Well, you have so many wonderful cheeses that I think you could just start with your favorite cheese. And, you know, whether it goes into a filling for a crepe or whether it's crumbled or sliced into combined into a salad, we still have citrus now, and citrus and cheese combined with like an escarole or radicchio, something that's a little bit sturdier. Those would be my immediate takes for right now.
I want to ask about a recipe that's been staring me in the face this whole time. The one on the cover of your book, it's just brilliant looking. I'll hold it up to the microphone so people can see it. It's a tomato tart, and it's this rectangular tart with these slices of tomato, I think whole cloves of garlic. Tell us about that one. It just looks so amazing.
It is. It's truly amazing. And the wonderful thing about this, and I use the Roma tomatoes or San Marzanos, the paste types, and they get confit a little bit in the oven before going into, this is a purchased puff pastry that's rolled out, and before going onto that, they're roasted in the oven so that some of their juices are concentrated so that the bottom of the crust doesn't get soggy. And this works perfectly well with the tomatoes that we find in our supermarkets right now. You cut them in half and bake them on the sheet, drizzled with olive oil, turn them over, roast the garlic cloves along with them, and then pack them into the prepared pastry shell with the garlic cloves. So that's a good example of in season, but it's okay to cheat.
And I want to ask you, Georgianne, about an ingredient now, eggplant, which this is a vegetable which I discovered I loved kind of late in life, maybe the last 3 or 4 years. Every time I had it by mistake, I would go, this is amazing, and then I would never have it again for another year. And all of a sudden I realized, you know what, I love eggplant. What can we do when the garden is booming with eggplant? Obviously the mind maybe goes to ratatouille if we're thinking of French food, but is there other stuff we can do with eggplant?
Yeah, one of the things to do is just roast them whole. Take the whole eggplant, rub it with a little olive oil, poke a few holes in it so that it doesn't explode in the oven, and roast it, and then just scrape out that luscious interior and add some fresh herbs to it, a little bit of olive oil, and some cheese, and it makes a wonderful spread for toast or a dip. Then also they make the best sandwich ever. Just grill the slices on your barbecue and then tuck them into some kind of soft rolls or ciabatta bread slathered with a little garlic mayonnaise.
Oh, that does sound really good.
Yeah. Can you leave us with some, you know, when we end up with too much in the garden, I think you've got a recipe or two for preserving things, a mixed vegetable fridge pickle, basically. What's your advice there?
Well, I think there are all kinds of things that we can preserve, and pickles that you just keep in the refrigerator. Refrigerator pickles are a good choice. I've got some fennel in my garden right now, baby turnips, and I'm going to pickle those. When it comes to tomatoes, I like to just cook them down, and then I freeze them in quart bags. Much easier than going into the jars. Those are my main things that I like to preserve. Also, drying tomatoes is good. Put them on a rack. Gosh, that's about the top of my preserving thrills.
And, Georgianne, before we let you go, do you still go back to Provence? Do you still have that little house there and go back and live some of this French country lifestyle?
I do. I do. I bought the house there in 1970, and I go back once or twice, you know, sometimes more. My children were young. We spent the whole summers there. And so, yes, I go back, and I'm always thinking, oh, it's going to be all different. It'll be changed. But, you know, after all these years, it's still very much the same rhythm, the same pace.
That sounds wonderful. Georgianne, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
That was Georgianne Brennan, James Beard Award-winning cookbook author, journalist, and entrepreneur. Her latest book is La Vie Rustic, Cooking and Living in the French Style. And you can find some of those recipes on the Facebook page.
A serious BBC interview on a South Korean political scandal took a lighter turn when the guest working from a home office got photobombed by his two small children.
And what will it mean for the wider region? I think one of your children has just walked in. I mean, shifting sands in the region. Do you think relations with the North may change?
I would be surprised if they do. Pardon me. My apologies.
And that video has justifiably gone viral with over 10 million views on the BBC Facebook page. The best part about that video, by the way, is that after the toddler comes into the video feed, that all of a sudden this baby in a walker speeds in right behind the toddler.
Everybody held together pretty well. It's just one of the risks of doing things live in the media. We've had some of our moments here. I was interviewing someone about dairy farming once, and it turned out he was in his farm, and his answer got interrupted by a really loud moo, which is actually good. There's ambience.
Ambience. Yeah. Yeah. And, well, I remember interviewing Tracy Morgan, who was, I guess, kind of famous for doing interviews while he's shopping at Whole Foods or whatever. When I got him, he happened to be getting a haircut. So toward the end, we hear the buzz of the hair clippers going on. It was kind of fun.
My favorite, and we knew this was coming, we interviewed a film critic about scary movies while he was giving out Halloween candy to trick-or-treaters. That was good. We knew it was coming. It wasn't a surprise. A lot of fun.
A little slice of real life here on Central Time.